All right, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Cherry Coolidge, Silent Phil in the ones and twos. Wow, 2020 just had another more 2020 craziness, Cherry. You were right there in Columbus last week. This is our first podcast since the news broke about Speaker of the House Larry Householder and a $60 million bribery scandal. What in the world, Cherry?
I mean, it was absolutely just the most stunning revelation that you could imagine. I mean, a lot of people were like, oh, the fix is in with House Bill 6, right? But like legally, because people, you know, with politics and people just kind of assumed there were backroom talks and there was some dark money, but the legal kind of dark money. And because it was just such this big bailout for taxpayers. And, you know, our special guest today, Chris Finney, is going to talk about the ballot initiative to repeal it. Even back during the campaign, he was saying there's something wrong. We're seeing the kind of pushback in this campaign, this failed campaign that never got off the ground, which is unlike, you know, his firm, because of, you know, now there's all these allegations of wrongdoing. But at the time, everyone was like, okay, but the amount of money and the alleged corruption that went into this. I mean, they called it like racketeering, and it is stunning.
Yeah, it really is. Sorry, I forgot to mention, yes, that Chris Finney is our special guest today. And you're right, Cherry. I would say he's one of Ohio's experts at ballot initiatives and, you know, going about petition drives, and I'm really, really interested to hear what he has to say. You had a great story last week on Cincinnati.com talking with him and about that, and just the deviousness of the scheming around this whole thing was just deep and heavy and I guess well thought out and well planned.
I mean, it just, we're supposed to be able to trust our lawmakers. And even with, you know, we saw Tamaya Dennard on Cincinnati City Council, right? What she was accused of doing and eventually pleaded guilty to was just this, you know, one shakedown of a developer with herself. But like the level here in our state government in Ohio of all of the problems in this systemic, you know, planning of things and working together and having just these five people put together a scheme, which is the alleged scheme, it's really hard to wrap your arms around. I mean, since this broke like a week ago, I've probably read like 30, 40 stories, all with different angles of this. I mean, there's going to be stories for weeks to come of all of the underbelly of how this all went down.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And, you know, has nothing to do with me, but my thoughts are, I just keep going back to January of 2019 when the decision was made, the proxy battle between Republican Ryan Smith and Larry Householder over who would be the next speaker. And full disclosure, Ryan Smith is from my hometown, Gallipolis, went to my high school. I don't know him personally, but my family knows him and he knows my family. And so I'm just, I don't know him at all. But I know of him as, you know, he seemed like a pretty upstanding lawmaker. He had a majority of Republican support, but the Democrats cut a deal, or Householder cut a deal with the Democrats and their union supporters to get him elected. And he, it's interesting, a lot of Democrats have been quiet about this, and that's exactly why, I believe, is that because the Democrats are very much complicit in putting him in as the Speaker of the House. And it's a little bit of a story, I think, that's kind of flown under the radar. And so when you look at sort of the longer term political implications, and people, you know, want to say, well, is this going to affect the 2020 election? my thoughts on that are, I don't think it will. I think Donald Trump's going to take care of that on his own. I think Trump's has a tough battle already in Ohio. I don't see this thing moving the needle. And I see if it does become part of messaging, where I think it could become part of messaging and, you know, maybe individual state house races overall in the state, across the state, statewide, for Trump. I don't think it hurts him. Hurts or helps him. I think it's, but it'll be interesting to see, Sherry, if this is used against, you know, certain Republicans in certain state house districts.
I mean, I don't think there's any question that this is going to be used in every single race somehow, because that's how, you know, political ads work. Same thing with City Hall. Like, everything that we hear about the whole Gang of Five case and Tamaya Denard, I mean, these things are going to be coming up in the council race in 2021. I mean, in the cutting of commercials and running against people, or for really even council, there is no chance that these things get left on the cutting room floor. And I think that we'll see a lot of misuse of it too, because that's how these ads go. I mean, we'll be vetting ads for probably years to come on this. But, you know, at the time it was very, I mean, I think you wrote about it, and I can remember the idea of Democrats like voting for him and why, right? And they talked about the promises, you know, there was just this whole discussion of like, they'd have a bigger say, right? Because just the Democrats would just get shut out of like all of the decision making. It's so Republican controlled. And Householder, you know, made some promises that people would have a better say, and they liked hearing that, right? That I'll work across.
Yes.
It sounded so great, right? I'll work across the aisle. Well, here he clearly.
Tops among those promises, Sherry, was that he promised not to push right to work legislation in his tenure as Speaker of the House. We look around at all the states around us, with the exception of Pennsylvania, all the bordering states of Ohio have right to work, including Michigan. And this is was a huge, huge concern for Ohio unions. And so Householder figured out a way, like, hey, I cannot get, because the Republicans or majority of the Republicans, I assume, realized how it went last time he was the Speaker, left under the cloud of another FBI investigation back in the early 2000s, 04. And so he figured out a way to go cut a deal. I mean, from just a shrewd political standpoint, it was pretty brilliant politics, just from, you know, taking it on the surface of politics. Hey, I can't get the Republican support. So, well, hey, there's what, 38 other folks in the House here. And so he went over to the Democrats and got 26 of the 38. So 12 people voted for Ryan Smith. Interestingly, all four Hamilton County Democrats in the state house, three of the four voted for Ryan Smith for Speaker. The only one who voted for Householder here was Cedric Denson, who was, I believe that was during, or he's in his first, he's finished up his first term in the state house. So he comes right in, right out of the gate after getting elected, and votes for Householder. But you're right, Sherry. I think this will certainly be used in state house races across the state. It'll be interesting, you know, when you drill down in the details of it. You know, is it in a race where a Democrat voted for Householder, or let's take for example, because I think this is one of the key state house races is right here in Hamilton County, and that's the 28th district. Chris Monzel will be facing Republican, will be facing incumbent Democrat Jessica Miranda. Jessica Miranda voted for Ryan Smith. She did not. She was one of the 12 who did not vote for Householder. She's already had messaging coming out, slamming, hey, the corruption of the Republicans. And so it'll be interesting to see. And obviously, Chris Monzel is a challenger He's had nothing to do with that. He's not really, he wasn't really one of Householder's hand-picked chosen ones. Householder has been very much a kingmaker in a lot of House districts. Gene Schmidt around here is an example of that. Chris Monzel, not so much. But I think for us here locally in Cincinnati, greater Cincinnati, that will be a race, that Monzel-Miranda race will be one to really watch to see how this messaging plays out and what is used in that in terms of how what's going on in Columbus right now, how all that stuff's used in that campaign.
No, I and agree with that, because these races, you know, the closer we get, the, you know, the more we start hearing about them. So there's certainly time before then. 100 days, 99 at this talking.
And let me be clear. Day. And let me be clear, too, from a political standpoint. The Republicans are in no danger of losing the state house.
The thing
they are in danger of losing is their supermajority. And so that 28th district race is a critical thing. The Democrats absolutely have to keep a hold of that seat in order for them to try to pick up another. I don't have the number off the top of my head. I think you can count it on one hand how many they need to get to break up the supermajority. But they absolutely have to keep that 28th district, which has gone back and forth over the years between Republicans and Democrats. And that 28th district, by the way, for folks who aren't familiar, it goes from Madeira, Blue Ash, Montgomery, Evendale, Glendale, Forest Park, Springdale. That's the district. So yeah, sorry, I'm getting a little bit going on politics.
Well, you know what?
That's what I do.
If we thought it was going to be slow this summer, that's not true, because this is a two-track story. The politics of everything and, you know, the court case that's going to start unfolding. I mean, there's no shortage of things to talk about here. You can get going all you want. This won't be the last time we talk about this.
No, and then the other thing, too, is Sherry, as we're recording this on Monday, Tuesday, the House Republican Caucus is going to meet to figure out what the heck to do. You know, what are they going to do? I mean, Larry Householder is showing no signs of resigning, and I don't see him resigning unless he is taken to let out by law enforcement because something had happened in this whole case. But that's, I mean, as you know, covering courts for years, Sherry, like this thing could drag out for really long time, right?
Well, I mean, they said themselves they're still investigating. So
yeah, so I don't see Larry Householder resigning, and so you got that whole issue at play. And who are these other 21 unnamed people in the affidavit, lawmakers? So how is that playing into the decision on trying to get Larry Householder out? Our Jesse Balmer, a state house reporter, wrote a story last week that the one way for him to be pushed out is the legislature, two-thirds of the legislature votes for him to resign, and that is one way to get him out. I don't see it right now, because who are these other 21? And you start to do the math and you're like, I'm not sure you're going to get to two-thirds right now, because who else could Larry Householder potentially throw under the bus in this whole thing? I'm just thinking out loud when you start to think about how this thing could play out. So certainly a stalemate is happening in Columbus, and it's ultimately no good for the citizens of Ohio.
No, exactly. So it's a lot still coming here.
Should we bring in Chris Finney?
Yeah, because I want to hear what he has to say about this whole ballot initiative. Like, he has some crazy stories from it.
Let's bring in Chris Finney. All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. And if my memory serves me well, I believe this is our first non-newsroom repeat guest on the podcast since we launched in right after Labor Day in 2018. And that would be none other than local attorney, from the Finney Law Firm, Chris Finney. Chris, how you doing?
Good, Jason. Sherry, it's good to be with you.
Good morning.
Well, you've certainly been, this has been a very busy year for you. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to right now.
Well, I mean, my day consists of running my law firm and my title company and dealing with my four grandkids and all my kids and everything. But, you know, part of our law practice is what we call public interest law. And it was last year we had this major case trying to get issued House Bill 6 on the ballot. And we've been doing a lot of COVID-related litigation this year, trying to get businesses reopened. We succeeded with the gyms. We succeeded with Kalahari Water Park. We haven't succeeded yet with some other ones, but we're waiting for some decisions. So that's occupied a lot of my time with trying to help businesses get reopened.
I jokingly tweeted after, the governor gave some kind of order that it's, you can otherwise call it the Christopher P. Finney Enrichment Act. Do you just monitor every single press conference, every single decision and order by the governor, and then decide whether to pursue a client, or does a client pursue you who's in that world?
That's actually a great question. So first of all, I sit on the board of a group in Columbus called the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law with our executive director is a guy named Maurice Thompson, who's a brilliant litigator. And people from all over the state call into the 1851 Center, in part because it provides pro bono legal services for public interest law issues. And so he many times asked me to help co-counsel some cases, and we do a lot through them. So a lot of the COVID litigation originated from the 1851 Center. Other people call us directly. And then occasionally we will sort of conceive of a case. And in the public interest arena, it's ethical, it's permissible to sort of put a plaintiff together and find the right way to position it. So Roe v. Wade from many years ago was actually a case, you know, that they put together. So it's possible to do that. We haven't done much of that. Most, and particularly with the publicity that we've gotten, the case has really come to us now. So, for example, you may remember last year the case of Jerry Isham, the black realtor who was arrested showing a home. And, you know, Jerry called me when that happened. We're getting a lot of calls about the COVID businesses. I've talked to so many businesses who have just been devastated with being closed. You know, they've devoted all of their fortune, all of their lives to try to build a business, and they've been put out of business, or they're operating at 50% of capacity, meaning they're losing money every month. And
the very first one was the bridal shop in Columbus. Is that right?
That's correct. Right. Yeah. The woman had a little entrepreneur, a small bridal shop in Columbus. And, you know, same story. You know, they tried, you know, it was their busy season, right? And they couldn't ply their trade. But I've had hundreds of phone calls with people who sincere, hardworking, taxpaying businessmen and women who created jobs for other people and employees who've been thrown out of work because of this. And some of them have lost everything and are just, you know, I don't know that it's anybody's fault. And they may want to blame the governor or whomever, but it's, you know, this COVID situation has come upon us very quickly and created just tremendous economic devastation. And I will tell you, I don't think we've seen the worst of the economic consequences of this, the bankruptcies and the personal, you know, just devastation of people's lives is untold because of what happened with COVID.
Wow.
So I deal with those phone calls quite a bit, and we help the people that we can. We were able to open up the gyms in Ohio. We were able to restart evictions in Hamilton County. We were able to open up Kalahari Water Park and to some extent Kings Island, and Cedar Point. We're working on getting daycares fully open. And by the way, the daycare crisis is just very pronounced because daycares are operating at 60% of capacity, and they're all losing money. And two things are happening there. One is that parents cannot find daycare spots for their children because there's so many fewer spots available. And two, the daycare operators are losing money, and eventually they're going to start closing. And we're not going to be able to provide in the way we have before daycare spaces. And then finally, with schools, some of the schools like Cincinnati Public being only in 2 days a week, what are these parents supposed to do who work? You know, they can't get daycare and they can't have their kid in school, and they're going to have to quit their jobs. So we're going to have significant societal impacts from all of this. And I'm not sure our government, you know, DeWine and even in Washington have thought all this through very well.
Do you feel like, though, I mean, I have read stories about it, that they understand that the problem, but there doesn't seem to be a solution to it other than fully reopening. And so that's why we're not hearing like plans and talking about daycare every single day, because there's no good answer.
Well, I think that, you know, in Columbus and in Washington, they're pretty well insulated from the pressures that people have in their daily lives. I think that particularly the early days of the pandemic showed that, when the governor thought he could shut down businesses across the state without, you know, consequence to people. And it just devastated them. I think that they're listening now because, first of all, we've got an election looming and politicians listen more closely. But secondly, I'm sure the governor's phone is ringing off the hook from ordinary people that are, you know, facing economic calamity at home. You know, there's a lot of personal problems, suicides, drug overdoses, depression. People aren't getting the health care that they need because they're afraid to go into the hospitals. The hospitals and health care providers are having financial difficulties because of that. So it's sort of a ripple effect throughout the economy. And I do think that they're starting to become aware of that. But early on, I don't think that they had any understanding. And it really showed the disconnect between our elected leaders, our bureaucrats, and the working people out in the community.
I would say the number one question, I mean, people ask me all the time, like, I know, and I don't know, because I just listen to the governor's press conferences like everybody else. But, you know, are they going to close bars and restaurants again? Like, I mean, I must have had like 25 texts yesterday just asking me that question. Do you feel like the lawsuits and what has happened leading up to this means that won't happen again?
Well, I think it's a question of what's going to happen with the virus and the hospitals. So I believe they have closed bars in places like Texas and Las Vegas and other places where they've had significant problems. So I think it depends upon how bad things get. But yeah, I think it's on the table. But on the other hand, I don't know. There is a greater awareness than there was back in March. That you just can't do that. I think the governor and the president understand that the health of this economy is dependent upon keeping people employed and working. And, you know, that drives everything. It drives the food supply chain. It drives the tax dollars into the city, county, and state governments and the federal government. And the notion that we can live sort of like North Korea, where all power and all economic activity emanates from Washington or Columbus, I think that they have some better understanding that that doesn't work anymore. So they seem reluctant to close bars and restaurants again, but I think it's possible if things get bad. Yeah.
What do you think about this broad order that Ohioans need, and other states too, of course, need to wear masks indoors?
You know, I have a number of thoughts about that. We've had a lot.
I knew you would. It's why I asked.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as doctrinaire as a lot of the clients who call and say, you know, this is illegal or unconstitutional or whatever. I think it's unfortunate. First of all, when businesses require it, so Kroger's or Target or whatever, they're allowed to do that. That's their private property right. up to the Americans with Disabilities Act and some other regulations that say, you know, children with autism, people with breathing difficulties, certain people cannot wear masks. And I don't know that I've heard stories from clients that have been harassed by businesses and they have legitimate medical conditions. And that's unfortunate. Secondly, from a legal standpoint, on the 1851 Center's website, we have a release, and we basically say that the governor's order is Swiss cheese. It's so full of holes. If you don't want to wear a mask, don't wear a mask. There's nobody that's going to prosecute you legitimately over that. And the 1851 Center has volunteered to provide a criminal defense to anyone who's charged with that. Thirdly, I'm amazed that I see people criticizing other people and screaming, and I've seen incidents where people are assaulted for not wearing a mask, but yet people go out into the community and are shopping and attending events as if it doesn't matter. The reality is, if you stay home and you're not a busybody telling other people what to do, you protect yourselves and your community a lot more. So if you feel strongly about the mask issue or about disease, don't go out. You can, you know, shop at Kroger's without going into the store from your cell phone, and they'll bring the stuff to your car. You can wear gloves when you go fill up your car with gas. And otherwise, why do you need to go need, if you think your life is in danger, why do you need to go out? And I don't think people do. And then, so there's been a lot of people wagging their finger at others about the mask just as a way to make them feel better about themselves. But the reality is, if you don't want to wear a mask, you don't have to. And except for private businesses, if they want to make you, then, you know, don't shop there, go shop somewhere else. But it's I wear one when I go into a business. And when I have a meeting, say in my office or with a client, I ask people, if you want me to wear a mask, I'll wear a mask. But as a general rule, to me, it's a matter of courtesy. It may be a matter of health, although I don't believe that it is. And but if you really want to be healthy, just isolate yourself from people and don't expose yourself or others to risk.
Do you think you said the governor's orders are Swiss cheese? The governor's an attorney, former attorney general. Why do you think that is? Is it because him and his team are learning on the fly, adjusting on the fly, political pressures? There's lawsuits for folks like yourself. Like, what? Why do you think it continues to be, like, in your mind, Swiss cheese?
Well, first of all, Jason, we have two common pleas court decisions out of Erie County and Lake County that very clearly say that Dr. Acton, or now Lance Himes, and Mike DeWine have no authority to issue these edicts. So, you know, we're a society of law, not a society of men. And there's nothing in the law that gives Governor DeWine unilateral, or the health director, unilateral authority to just tell businesses they have to close and people they have to wear masks. It's not in the law. And when we've had two different judges look at that, they have both ruled just that way. So there is nothing that gives the governor or the health director the authority to just issue edicts. You know, when you were in high school, Jason, they taught us, you know, how, or maybe grade school, how laws are made. It starts with the House and Senate, and it's signed into law by the president or the governor. And none of that happened in this instance. The governor just assumed the authority to tell people that they had to close their businesses, stay home, and wear masks. And none of that was authorized by statute. So that's the starting point. And then within the governor's order itself, there's all kinds of exceptions of health exceptions and otherwise. And you will not, you know, we had a business that was cited to have their it was a restaurant, to have their restaurant license yanked. I think it was food service license yanked. And we briefed that, and the first of all, the county attorney withdrew from the case and said there's no legal justification for this. And then the judge issued a TRO last week. So, you know, the one business that has been cited in Ohio was vindicated when defended under this. So there is no serious attempt. I think they're doing it maybe for some publicity, but there's no serious broad attempt to enforce these laws, and they are unenforceable.
So do you think then that the governor is doing a better job, a worse job, the same job since Dr. Acton resigned in early June?
I think he clearly has been a little bit more restrained in the things that he's been doing. I'm a friend of Mike DeWine's, and I don't want to be critical, yeah. But I will say that, you know, when you don't have the constitutional authority to do the things that you're doing, what you ought to do is go back to the legislature and seek approval of that or stop doing it. And so any governor who willfully violates and repeatedly violates his statutory and constitutional duties, I think is abusing his power, and it's inexcusable. And, you know, we all say, well, it'll all be over in 6 months, or all be over in a year, and all will be forgiven. Well, I don't think so. I think actually, Jason, we've written the roadmap for authoritarianism in this country. When we have a dictator who wants to take over, he's just going to cite the pandemic exception that, that some of the courts have authorized to the United States Constitution and assume powers that he does not have. That's not how we do things in this country.
No doubt. It's very concerning. And you mentioned the legislature, and I think that's a good point for us to sort of shift gears. And I'm going to let Sherry jump in on this and ask you about, you know, what's going on in Columbus right now and what, you know, your involvement with that last year.
Sure. Well, Jason and I did talk about this a little bit earlier in our conversation leading up to our special guest segment. But you and I did have an opportunity to talk about what that ballot initiative was like. And it's just the details of it are absolutely so crazy. So I want you to tell our listeners some of the things you were telling me, because you saw things you never thought you'd see. Is that right?
And Sherry and Jason, you both know I've been around the horn. I've been involved in city council, county commission, congressional races. I've been involved in statewide races. I've, you know, done litigation relating to and legal advice relating to all of these things over the years. But this was unlike anything I had ever seen. So first of all, you know, Cincinnati really is somewhat disconnected from Columbus. So this House Bill 6 debate and what was going on, even though I'm somewhat plugged in, I think I was not really aware of what was going on with the passage of the legislation and so on. I must have missed all the news articles about it.
I've given a lot of thought to it, because every Ohioan, of course, has to pay the fee that was at the heart of passing this. And I think that it was because it was First Energy, which is the provider of energy in Northern Ohio and not Duke Energy. I feel like if you had just swapped out the language there and it was our actual energy company, people would have been like, oh, that's what I pay. But saying First Energy, I think, just made people tune out. But anyway, because I've been thinking, like, why so many people I talk to are just like, they are like, what happened? I don't know about this. And it was covered. I just think a lot of people tuned it out. So sorry.
No problem. But I was at my desk and I got a call from a co-counsel in the case with another law firm who wanted the assistance of our firm. And Kurt Hartman is of counsel with our firm, who's a brilliant drafter and attorney who really understands deeply these election laws and constitutional laws, and he wanted him on the team. So we put a team together, but he told me stories. This phone call told me stories about what was going on in a referendum petition drive that was just, you know, made my hair curl if it wasn't already curly. But so, you know, under Ohio law, when the legislature, so my point was with the original part of the story is that The part of the nefarious stuff had already happened before I ever got involved, which was in the passage of the legislation of greasing the palms of legislators and bureaucrats up in Columbus to make this happen. There's an insider game up there that we're not even a part of. We don't even know about a lot of people in Cincinnati, and it's really bad. It's really bad. But the law had already been passed, and under Ohio Constitution, when the legislature passes a law, the people have a right of referendum of that if you get a certain number of signatures. And you have a limit of time, 90 days, to do that. And that time is eaten up in part of waiting for the Secretary of State and the Ohio Attorney General to approve your petition language. So by the time the petition drive started, they had fewer than 60 days to circulate the petitions and get, you know, statewide and all kinds of legal requirements to get something on the ballot. And for starters, these petition drives of this magnitude and this short a time frame are almost always run by paid petitioning companies. And that leaves a bad taste in some people's mouths. But the reality is that voters will never have a right to vote on anything if you didn't use paid petitioners. So the first step was the committee for the referendum, you know, tried to hire petitioning companies who do this nationwide, and they fly in and people and hire local people as well. And householder group, Larry Householder and Neil Clark and their bunch, had already paid many of the petitioning companies like $100,000 each to stay out of the fight. They said, we're going to give you $100,000 to just not come into Ohio at all. And he bought off a lot of the petitioning companies. And then when we flew people in, we had to file something called a Form 15 for every organizer and every petitioner, which included their email address and their cell number. And so with that information, and it's public record, so the other side would contact our people and say, we'll pay you $2,500 and give you a plane ticket back home to just stop working on this petition drive. And then in the petitioning business, there's paid petitioners, but there's also something called blockers. And paid blockers are people who come in. So, Sherry, if you're at Blink downtown, which is one of the places where we circulated this year, and you want to circulate a petitioner, you're at the Bengals game, Sherry's going to go to the Bengals game, I'm going to approach you with a petition and say, hey, would you sign this to put it on the ballot? The blockers are paid to come over, stand between you and me, scream and holler and argue. And Sherry throws up her hands and says, oh my gosh, you know, this is not worth the trouble. I'm going to leave rather than be part of this fight. And they slow you down because petition collecting is a matter of time. So it's signatures per hour. And so instead of a petitioner getting 50 signatures in an hour, they might get 10. And they aggressively paid blockers to just swarm. Like, we would have one petitioner that would be surrounded by five blockers and preventing them from getting signatures. We had two instances where our petitioners were assaulted, physically assaulted. One had to go to the hospital when they were assaulted by the blockers. And then finally, we had one of our petitioners was asked to do corporate espionage, where they said, we'll pay you $15,000 if you'll spy on the other side and tell us the inside inner workings of the campaign, how many signatures they have, how it's going, how our blocking efforts are going. And that's the person that was, it's been reported in the newspaper that the FBI, he went to the FBI, they wired him, and they got inside information about the corporate espionage and the blocking efforts of the Neil Clark, Larry Householder group that Matt Borges, that were all arrested eventually. But it was overwhelming the amount of money that they had. There were rumors of them paying people $25,000, some of our organizers, not $2,500, but $25,000 to leave town and quit working on the campaign. We had stories that they were actually, so our petitioners would have a day of petitioning or 3 days of petitioning and might have 200 signatures in their possession. And there were stories of them buying the signatures from them so they could shred them rather than be part of our totals. But we were shocked.
If you read the affidavit and you start doing some math, we're talking about like $20 million they poured into this. That kind of money. But I mean, we were talking about $1 billion in taxpayer bailout. So, you know, the entire, you know, scheme as outlined in this affidavit was $60 million, but $20 million of it was poured into making sure that it didn't get repealed. There was no amount of money that was too much to make sure that stayed a law, if you read the affidavit.
Right. And then think about this, Sherry, that $20 million was spent in a concentrated period of about 5 weeks' time. They were pouring in money to stop and slow down our petition drive. And to see that level of aggressive effort, and it ramped up. So earlier on, they would only pay our people, you know, $1,000 to leave town. And by the end, they were paying them $2,500 and a plane ticket to leave town. So that huge amount of money you just identified was spent in a very concentrated period of time. And then we went into court, we sued to try to stop that and to ask the court to give us more time because of the dirty tricks that had been played. And we were not successful in being able to do that, in part, again, because they spent a lot of money on lawyers because they knew this would be coming to keep us at bay, and they succeeded. So two pieces to this, Sherry. One is it was a $1.3 billion tax on Ohioans that will appear on your electric bill that the legislature passed with a lot of money greasing palms up in Columbus. And there's a whole story about that, you know, where they actually paid to get people elected and put their team in place so they'd have the votes to pass this. Then they passed it. Then they spent, as you point out, this $20 million or more blocking us from getting to the ballot so the people could vote on it. They put millions of dollars on television with dishonest TV commercials saying it had something about the Chinese taking over our electric grid, which was total horse manure. And to be in the middle of this flood of money that was aimed at a negative, which was to prevent us from exercising our constitutional rights to put this issue on the ballot, was really disconcerting. And it was frustrating for me as an attorney not to have the legal tools or the ear of a judge who understood the gravity of what was happening to come to our aid. And it was because we did not succeed at that stage, and it was frustrating.
So, I mean, the question really is, of course, like, what happens now? Because I feel like, you know, they are talking about repealing House Bill 6, right? And starting over, right? And having a new vote. But at the very least, I feel like the citizens should have another chance. Like, if that doesn't happen, the citizens are cheated out of their constitutional right to repeal this. And that there should be another 90-day chance to try this again. Am I off the mark there?
Well, Sherry, not only that, but if the governor and the legislature really feel strongly that this should be the law, which I can't imagine wanting to give $1.3 billion to people who paid the bribes, all they're going to do is turn around and give money to crooks all over again at First Energy. It's unseemly. But let's assume that they want to do that. If they want to do that, there were two levels of offense here. One was passing the law to begin with, and two was depriving the people who otherwise would have had a vote to do that. Why not have the legislature just put it on the ballot and let's have a public discussion about this $1.3 billion tax that's going to go to a company of crooks who paid $60 million of bribes into our legislature? Let's have that public vote. I'd love to have that vote. But why do they think that they can still do an insider game and deprive the voters of their participation in this, which is exactly what they were denied with all of this money?
So, I mean, I think this is really what's going to start unfolding this week. I mean, we're barely into knowing the details of it. And of course, one of my favorite details of the affidavit is, from the FBI is, we're just putting enough information in here to prove the crime. There's so much more. So we're just getting started here. But it'll be interesting to see what the legislature does.
Well, and Sherry, one of the things you said there is very important, which is so often we hear about corporations paying fines. Somebody pays a fine and they get out of it, you know, millions or even billions of dollars in fines. I want to see people go to jail from First Energy. Somebody was involved. Somebody engineered this whole thing, and it needs to stop. throughout state government, we have a First Energy, you know, former this and former that, very high up in the administration and in the legislature. And we need to divorce ourselves from these crooks and become aware of who these people are. But people from First Energy need to go to jail, as well as Larry Householder and the rest of the people involved in the crimes.
I mean, the U.S. attorney, David DeVillers, he did say, you know, this is just the first wave of everything they're looking at. There's more to come. But no, I do feel like we should say nobody from First Energy has been charged. People in our news network have reached out to them for comment. They deny any wrongdoing. They said how they did things is, you know, they talk to attorneys and things are totally above board. So I do want to put that out there, but DeVillers himself has said we don't know everything yet.
Yeah, well, so often the corporate wrongdoers, you know, out of the whole mortgage crisis that almost sunk this nation's economy back in 08, one low-level person at one of the securities companies went to prison, one person, and the rest of them all got off scot-free. And I'm tired of seeing a fine being levied as the solution to this. Corporate heads need to roll as well as the legislators.
Great stuff, Chris. Thanks. I mean, one other thing I would want to sort of throw at you is on this before we jump off. But don't you think also one of the challenges to repealing is the fact that Larry Householder is continuing as the Speaker of the House right now? And I think the one who controls the agenda.
I think the people who voted. Look, let's tell the whole story. Larry Householder had almost been indicted back in 04 or 06 by the FBI and left Columbus in disgrace, went back to wherever he's from, Highland County, and didn't reemerge for 15 years. And then the legislators made him speaker again, knowing his checkered background. So the people who voted for him and put him in as speaker should be hanging their heads in shame, and they should all lose their seats. But beyond that, they need to remove him as speaker promptly and hopefully put somebody in who has a stellar reputation, because the person that they chose, by the way, just so you know, Larry Householder could not get majority Republican votes to become speaker again. So he was put in by 26 Democrats and 26 Republicans, kind of in an unprecedented vote. And, he needs to be removed post haste. And don't forget, Jason, the speaker prior to him, Cliff Rosenberger, also left under an FBI investigation, was almost indicted. So we've had three corrupt speakers of the House, two of them named Larry Householder, and then Cliff Rosenberger. And we have a bad history. So if the Republican Party can't cleanse itself up there and figure out a way to have honest lawmaking and honest speakers, then they don't deserve to have power up there.
Great stuff, Chris. Thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll be keeping track of what you're working on.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. It's always good to hear from you.
Thanks. Thanks.
Thanks again to Chris Finney. Sherry, it actually hit me there right as I was introducing him, that he's our first repeat guest, special guest on the podcast, I'm pretty sure. And he had a lot of interesting things to say there today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew, like, he was a good guest to talk about this. I feel like a guest coming up, too. We have a lot to cover in the weeks to come with actual county elections coming up and the presidential race. But I think this is going to be a hot topic, and there's a lot more people to talk about with this stuff. But I thought he'd be a good one out of the gate, because he was saying from the get-go there were problems.
Yep. No, it was good stuff. And I always enjoy talking with Chris Finney. Let's segue into the fun portion of the show. And Sherry, when you and I were talking about planning the episode, you said, I have a lot of fun stuff to talk about. I didn't ask you what that was because I wanted to be surprised. What's going on?
I do have to say, it might seem like I'm working here, but I am taking a couple days off. It has been such a huge news year, of course. I just haven't really taken any vacation days too much here, so I'm taking a couple days off. But we are in the middle of a pandemic, so what are the outside things to do? And so I have like the ultimate staycation plan. It started over the weekend. And I have to say, I did one of the most fun things I've ever done in Cincinnati. I went on the SS Tiki boat. It's not intuitive. It's not. In Ohio, it's not intuitive.
The SS Tiki boat?
I did. It was so fun.
Tell us a little bit about that. I've never heard of this.
So it's new. It started this year. And a lot of the news organizations wrote stories about it at the beginning of the summer. And so when I was looking for things to do, it became really like this massive list of looking at every, you know, 10 things to do outside in Cincinnati, the 50 best things in Cincinnati this summer, like all those kind of lists. I kind of combed through them. And this came up a couple times, and it just is like, can rent the tiki boat, up to 6 people for 4 hours just on the Ohio. And like, it has a boat captain, so you don't have to drive it. You can bring a picnic on the boat. And we just, you know, we went on opening day and we're cruising right past the Reds stadium. And it was so crazy of like thinking about past years when I would be there or around it, and it was just completely empty. And all of the different, like, you're just up and down the river and seeing, you know, both sides of the river from a different vantage point. I had such a good afternoon, and it, we had beautiful weather, which always helps. But I have to say, it was really a good afternoon that was surprising the pandemic, honestly.
That sounds like a lot of fun. It was nice, it was hot, but a sunny day, right?
It was, which, you know, helps if you're going on a boat ride. But honestly, there's not a lot of boat rides around here. Of like, you have BB River boats. It's a different kind of experience, though. And so if you want to go out on the Ohio, and of course, we're kayakers, right? And we pretty much stick to lakes and a little Miami. This was a way to really see things on the Ohio.
That's awesome. Did you see any kayakers out there?
No, not on, you know, we didn't, not on the Ohio. Other boaters and jet skiers too. A lot of jet skiers.
Yeah, the reason why I asked you was it a nice day here is because I was wrapping up my 2-week staycation in South Carolina, and I jokingly say that because my parents just moved down there to the Low Country. They call it the Low Country of South Carolina. It's Beaufort County, Bluffton, Hilton Head, Beaufort. The town of Beaufort, right near Savannah, Savannah Hilton Head region. My parents just moved down there in February and sold our farm out in Southeast Ohio. And so this is kind of our first longer trip to sort of hang out with them and take in their new house and hang out there. And it's basically what we did. We just found different activities around there and it's plenty to do and did some kayaking, Sherry. I'll tell you, being away for 2 weeks. Yeah, I did not bring the kids. I went with my brother-in-law who lives in Savannah. We did not bring the kids on kayaking, but we have discussed that, and I think that's in our future. But I'll tell you, Sherry, taking 2 weeks off is it's nice on one hand, and it's nerve-wracking on the other, because especially when a big news story breaks, you just you know the feeling of the adrenaline rush and wanting to be there in the middle of the story, and so to be on vacation while the householder news broke was I don't know, my thoughts were it was so 2020, because the next when is a good time to take vacation in 2020?
Definitely sort of my thoughts, no time. But honestly, so, I mean, you're back for the political fallout, right? Last week was honestly about that affidavit in this court case. There's a million stories in that affidavit, you know, 80-some pages of just bombshell after bombshell. And so last week was really the court case. This is the week for the political fallout. I'm interested to see, you know, what you're going to hear and find when you really, the political reporting on this is, that's going to start this week and hearing about these things. And we talked earlier about, you know, even in really the Chris Monzel race, and there's just so much politics here and what's going to happen with householder themselves. So you're coming back at a good time, like on the tail end of the court case which there's more to come on that. I'm being told, of course. So, yeah. But yes, here comes the politics.
Here comes the politics. Yeah, glad to be back. I'm excited about it. Anything else fun going on, Sherry?
Well, we'll find out this week. I have a lot of things planned.
Oh, you get to...
All outdoors. Nice. Which, you know, and you still have to stay safe and wear your mask at different places. And I'm being very cognizant of that. But I'm excited to explore the city that I live in. I don't get a chance to do that much. And there's a lot of fun things here.
Now, have you kind of planned this whole thing out? Have you laid out every day? Or
I have.
Oh, that's cool.
I have, because I'm using this as a chance. I do have a friend in town who I grew up with. Very much a part of my family, and taking this chance to see my son, right, where I don't have to be like, mommy's on the phone. Since we work at home now, you know, he hears that sentence a lot, and I know that he does. And so the week is also very much planned to include him and do fun things with him in Cincinnati.
Love it. I think that's the way you have to do a staycation, because I think I told you this. I tried to do one, I don't know, a couple years ago, and it was awful. I didn't feel like I got away. I just felt like I was just working. I took work calls a lot and sort of, but
I mean,
my problem
was, I'll still take tips. Let's not get crazy.
but my problem was I didn't plan anything out the way you have. You've already done some fun things. You're exploring. And to me, that's how you do a staycation, is you actually go do things like you would do on vacation. You're just doing them here and,
We went to Ziegler Pool. We kind of got the feeling like that's just a different kind of a pool experience. You have to make reservations. It was very socially distanced, which my little tip there is those reservations fill up quickly. You can book Ziegler 2 weeks out. It's $4, which is basically the same price as it was when you would walk up. And it's a different experience this summer. I've been there in the past, very, very crowded, but they socially distanced it with two different seatings. So you can't stay there all day long. There's people with season passes seatings, and then you don't need a season pass seatings. And so that was a great experience, like kind of just being downtown and all the people watching at Ziegler Pool and the people who go by. So that was fun too.
Love it.
Nice pool. I mean, we have to throw 3CD some TC some love on that pool. It's a really nice pool, right in the heart of downtown. Really, over the Rhine.
We'll look forward to, I think we already have our fun segment covered for next week, too, to hear about what you did all this week as a part of your staycation. So looking forward to hearing about that and catching up with you next week.
All right. You know, I did take my friend to the Loveland Bike Trail and 50 West last night. You know I did, right?
Oh, I did not know that.
We did that, of course, right? Like, that's like, I mean, honestly, he's like, you've talked about that so much. Let's go. I want to see your bike ride, right? Like, we go so much and do so much. So when I talk to him, I've talked about it. He wanted to see it. And so we did that last night.
And how was it?
In the evening, you know, it's a lovely ride in the evening. Usually we go early. I'm an early bird. I like to wake up early, much to my family's chagrin. because you really don't want to go in the heat of the day. But we went late in the evening. It was just as crowded. In fact, we got the last parking spot out there on a Sunday night. So that's very much as popular as it has been.
Great stuff, Sherry. We'll look forward next week to talking about all your latest adventures. One thing you know how to do, and that's just, you know how to have fun and find all these different cool things around Cincinnati: restaurants, breweries, kayaking, boating. I always leave it to you. Is when I'm looking for something to do in Cincinnati, I always just turn to you and ask you, hey, what should Bethany and I do for fun, or the kids, or whatever?
This is where I want to throw some love for the people at the Inquirer who do the calendar and the things to do list. These lists come on Fridays, and I read them even if I don't do everything on them, and they kind of know what's going on. And so those lists were important when I was looking at all those things to do. So that news you know, is very much, we talk about the political news all the time. So important, right? We love and we, you know, we're way in the weeds and we want people to read our coverage. But when you work for a newspaper, it's all the different kind of stories, right? You know, watch Catherine Nero's coffee talk with Catherine. She goes to all of these fun things and talks about them this summer and these things to do calendars. It's where I got a lot of the ideas of things to do. And so that's just as much news because it involves our personal life. And that's, and so anyway, but so shout out to that. Not always just the hard, big news. It's it. Other coverage.
Exactly. And just go on Cincinnati.com, search things to do, and the latest calendar should pop up and tell you everything that's going on around greater Cincinnati. Anyway, thanks again so much for listening. If you missed last week's episode with a new city manager, Paula Boggs Muthing, go back and check that out. She talked about her personal story of becoming what everything that's led her up to personally and professionally to becoming the new city manager of the city of Cincinnati. So check that out on all your favorite podcast listening platforms. We're getting some emails. Keep emailing us. JWilliams@inquirer.com, SCoolidge@inquirer.com. And we will catch you next week.